from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday's stunning upsets by John Kerry and John Edwards in Iowa have turned the Democratic primary race on its head. Dean staggered, Clark on the move, the laggards now leading. The candidates, minus Dick Gephardt, are back in New Hampshire, and Democrats have some thinking to do. Tonight on Point, Iowa shakes up the storyline, and New Hampshire is up for grabs. We look at what comes next. But first, we begin in New York, where home design mogul Martha Stewart today pled not guilty to five criminal counts, including conspiracy, for her 2001 sale of ImClone stock. Lawyers from both sides today also began narrowing the field of potential jurors. Barney Gimbel is covering the trial for Newsweek. He joins me now from New York. Hello, Barney.
Hello. Good to be here.
It's good to have you with us. Were you inside the courtroom today? Was it open?
I was inside the courtroom, but it was, as you were saying, it was a closed courtroom, or the jury was in there sitting on there in the jury stand one by one going into the chamber. So it really was a much more of a big day for the jurors. They had to one by one sit in the judge's robing room and be right there in front of Martha and her gaggle of lawyers and prosecutors.
So Martha Stewart was there as the lawyers talked to the jurors, screening them to see who they want and who they don't want.
Exactly.
Remind us of the charges in this case, Barney.
The charges are essentially lying to federal prosecutors and federal authorities. There's also a charge of securities fraud thrown in there, basically. But it's essentially a case that revolves around lying.
And this dates back to December 2001. Martha Stewart sold $51,000 worth of ImClone shares when her stockbroker, had told her, is that what's disputed?
No, her stockbroker had left a message to let Martha know that there's points of contention here, but essentially letting her know that the price was going down for ImClone, and possibly, this is where there's a dispute, and possibly if the Waxels were actually selling their own stock as well.
Sam Waxel and family.
Right.
This in anticipation of a government report that would have thrown doubt on a prime ImClone cancer drug that
Correct.
Later sent the stock plummeting. So here's Martha Stewart. What's she facing if this all goes against her, Barney?
She's facing 30 years in a federal penitentiary. But, you know, there's a lot of charges and a lot of different legal angles to be said. This is only the beginning.
How long is this trial likely to go on?
Well, assuming they start trial next week in terms of jury selection being done this week, they're suggesting it'd be about six to eight weeks.
6 to 8 weeks. Martha Stewart is 62 years old now. She's such a public figure. And there she was today. Was there a wild media scene outside, inside?
It really was. The media was setting up, the TV cameras were setting up the night before, actually 24 hours in advance, staking out the right place on the square across the street from the federal courthouse here in Manhattan. And they were all there starting at 6 a.m., ready and waiting for her to arrive. And she was on time exactly at about 9.
On the one hand, Martha Stewart is a real businesswoman. She built a billion-dollar company. On the other hand, she's all about how things look. How did she look today?
Well, I tell you, that was what the press was talking about the whole day, waiting for her to come in. She was wearing a brown jacket, matching brown pants, and brown boots. It was very understated. There was no famous umbrella like we had last time she appeared.
Did she look anguished, or was she cool?
She seemed very calm and cool, actually. Very quiet in the courtroom. In fact, when she was pleading not guilty today, we sitting in the second row of the courthouse, we could barely hear her. It was very quiet, and any other suggestions from the judge were nods, yes or no.
Do you have any idea what the prosecution is looking for in the jury pool, what the defense is looking for?
Well, I mean, jury experts say, and Newsweek's reporting says, I mean, essentially it's the prosecution is looking for a jury that sees the law and black and white. You know, this is right, this is wrong. The prosecution is looking for a more sort of sophisticated class, perhaps, that sees the lighter shades of gray.
And is there any more room for negotiation? What's the buzz? What are people expecting here? Martha Stewart in the slammer for years or not?
Well, it's really too early to say. I mean, you can never really underestimate Martha Stewart and what she's capable of doing. There is no deal. We're all assuming it was offered to her before. And she's pleading not guilty, and she's serious about it.
But the stakes are very real. Barney Gimbel, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's good to be here. Thanks.
Barney Gimbel is special correspondent for Newsweek magazine. He joined me from New York. Iowa's front runners and a new underdog had landed in New Hampshire by early this morning and went straight to the hustings. This was a reborn John Kerry in Manchester, New Hampshire.
We here in New Hampshire have a chance to be able next Tuesday to give America back its future and its soul at the same time. And I count on you to do that.
Iowa has spoken with 38% for Kerry, 32% for Edwards, 18% for Dean, and 11% for Dick Gephardt. Gephardt is now out of the race. Kerry and Edwards are praying to hold on to their momentum. And Howard Dean, whose defiant howl in defeat played even on rock and roll stations today, is suddenly playing catch-up. General Clark, who skipped the Iowa caucus, has made real headway in New Hampshire. As the candidates move into the live free or die state, we'll look at last night's upset and what it bodes for next week's primary and the race ahead. Tonight on Point, the fast changing dynamics of the Democratic campaign. What happened last night? Where was Dean? Will he be back in New Hampshire? What's the new charm of Kerry, of Edwards? Will it last? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Des Moines, Iowa, is Kathy Obradovich, political editor for the Des Moines Register. Good evening and welcome, Kathy Obradovich.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you. Also with us from New York is Brian Murphy, senior editor of PoliticsNH.com, a political news website for New Hampshire voters. He's also vice president of the Publius Group, which operates political news websites in five states. Good evening and welcome, Brian Murphy.
Hi, how are you tonight?
We're great. Kathy, first to you, what happened out there?
Well, I think we saw a pretty interesting phenomenon, one that you don't see very often in Iowa caucuses. The front runner and the second runner ended up placing third and fourth in the Iowa caucuses.
And a deep third and a deep fourth.
Yes, exactly. John Kerry and John Edwards seemed to surge on a wave of popularity that really just whipped up in the last final weeks of the campaign, and were able to hold on to that momentum right through last night.
Right through the caucuses. Polls are often dismissed in politics, but the polls had this one just right. They had the order just right coming into the final days, but there was some kind of flip that went on here if the polls were right earlier. What was it that won Kerry and Edwards this or lost Dean and Gephardt this?
Well, I think that there's been a lot of speculation about what happened with Howard Dean. But I think some of the keys were, he may have peaked too early. His momentum was on the rise right up through the endorsement of Al Gore, but it sort of stopped cold with the capture of Saddam Hussein, caused Democrats who really, bottom line, were just looking for an electable candidate, somebody who can beat George W. Bush, started questioning Howard Dean's viability if the fortunes of war turn in favor of President Bush.
Because he'd been anti-war, and suddenly Bush had some success, and did they need a different profile to confront Bush?
Exactly. And at the same time, I think the dynamics of the campaign, where Howard Dean and Dick Gephardt had been the front runners in Iowa for many, many weeks, they had been criticizing each other and really kind of ripping each other apart. They managed to raise each other's negatives and allow Kerry and Edwards to kind of step over the bodies into the lead.
And what about the positives on Kerry and Edwards? John Kerry first. How much of it was his Vietnam experience in uniform? How much was his long experience in Capitol Hill? What about his personality? Everybody thought, well, it's not really selling. This New Englander, as he reminded everyone he is last night, wasn't really selling in Iowa. And then he was, like hotcakes.
Well, I think that all three played a role. He had trouble early because he had voted in favor of the war resolution and yet was campaigning as an anti-war candidate. And yet people were willing to take another look at him when they began to have concerns about Howard Dean's foreign policy experience. His character, I think, he has always had the rap of being aloof, but that's not the experience Iowa Iowans had really seen on the campaign trail. He had really worked on, making himself seem warm. You know, he touches people on the campaign trail. You know, he is intensely interested in what they have to say. And
he thanked Iowans last night, saying they had changed him during the course of his campaign, his very heavy campaigning there. Is that the change maybe we're talking about, that more personal, more warm, more open, Kerry?
Well, that is certainly the style that we have seen from him, and clearly Iowans responded to that.
And John Edwards, sunshine and sincerity.
Exactly. Yeah. One thing that we heard from a lot of people who at the very end decided to give John Edwards a try was that they liked his optimistic approach. They were very turned off by the negative attacks from Dean and Gephardt. And, you know, we're really, I think, sort of wowed by his performance in some of the recent debates, really just thought that they'd give him a chance.
So what do you end up thinking here, Kathy? Are Iowans just a softer touch than some other states? Turning away from the harder tone of Dean toward the softer Edwards, the distinguished Kerry. Do you think the message out of Iowa is one that's going to be picked up and carried in other states? Do you have any idea?
Well, I think that it's interesting that Iowa Democrats, who have often been considered to be more liberal, the caucus goers are considered to be more liberal than Democrats in general in Iowa, actually went with more moderate establishment candidates in this caucus race. You know, I think it may say something about how they view the winning hand in the battle to win back the White House, that the diving to the left, which Howard Dean tried to convince them was the only way to win back the White House may not be the way they think. The battle will be won.
So they may have held on to the reins of that more left-leaning instinct here in the interest of winning.
Yeah, exactly.
Brian Murphy, you're watching this from New Hampshire. Here we've got everything turned upside down coming into the live free or die state. How does it reshuffle the board there?
Well, clearly, the way the polls have been tracking, Dean's been at about 30%, and then The other major candidates have been around 20, except for Edwards. I'd imagine now that all those poll numbers are really pretty much history. I mean, there wasn't much movement in the tracking polls that were done today. Some ones were released at 6 o'clock, and there was a minor shift of support from Clark over to Kerry. I'd imagine that trend will continue, but the consequences for Dean are going to be interesting to see.
I mean, do you think New Hampshire's going to say, holy smokes, we've got to get off this Dean bandwagon, Iowa's sending us a big signal, are they going to stick with their guns? He's been ahead, will he stay ahead another week and win it there?
Well, there's a funny trend that sometimes happens in New Hampshire, which is that, you know, New Hampshire voters are very conscious of their role in picking a candidate, and sometimes they'll go ahead and do exactly what the opposite of what happened in Iowa, just to sort of cement their uniqueness and their odd position in this in the primary season and the difference between the caucus and the primary vote.
So we're not going to be ditto heads here in New Hampshire.
Exactly, but yeah, I think there clearly have to be consequences, just momentum consequences for Kerry and Edwards, and it's been especially telling that, you know, there are two states essentially where people get, for a long period of time, contact with the presidential candidate, where you don't have this sort of one week they drop in and there's a big media blitz. And that's in New Hampshire and Iowa. And what's interesting is that Dean's core message has been anti-war, right, since this got started. And it seems that Kerry's argument that by voting for the resolution, he was signifying support for the country, but, you know, his argument that he, like many other Americans, feel that they've been misled. That's a good antidote to Howard Dean's argument that, you know, Dean knew better than the other candidates.
Dean's more absolutist line on it. Kathy Obradovich, we just have you for another minute. I have to ask you about the famous, infamous Howard Dean rebel yell last night. Has that been getting the airtime in Iowa that it has elsewhere? And what do people make of it?
Absolutely. You know, I have heard lots and lots of reaction to that, ranging from, gosh, I think he was drunk, to, gosh, I think he was doing his best to, you know, kind of fire people up going into New Hampshire.
Did it leave Iowans thinking they'd done the right thing?
Well, I think a lot of people did. I think there was a lot of discussion about it reinforcing people's opinions that he didn't have presidential temperament.
Kathy Obradovich, we've got to let you go, but thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for being here.
Kathy Obradovich, political editor at the Des Moines Register. We're talking tonight about upset in Iowa and the crowded house of Democratic contenders now descending on New Hampshire. What the heck is going on here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the upset in Iowa and the road now to New Hampshire. Where was Dean last night? Will he come back in New Hampshire? Can he survive his rebel yell? And how did John Kerry pull this off? Can he keep it rolling? And what about Edwards, Johnny Sunshine? Will it work in cold New Hampshire? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. John Edwards, a strong second-place showing in Iowa last night. Here he was in Concord, New Hampshire this morning.
I am talking to voters, listening to voters, hearing what they have to say. While other candidates have been spending a lot of time talking about each other, I've been talking about the problems that people face in their lives. I love campaigning here in New Hampshire. I know the people of New Hampshire, and I intend to work my heart out here in New Hampshire.
And there he is, John Edwards with a new lease on life, John Kerry with a new lease on life, Howard Dean with a whole new set of imponderables in front of him, and Wesley Clark and Joe Lieberman, and it's a big gang there. We're talking tonight with Brian Murphy. He's joining us from New York. He's senior editor at PoliticsNH.com, a political news website for New Hampshire voters. We're joined now from Hanover, New Hampshire, by Linda Fowler. She's professor of policy studies at Dartmouth College and author of Candidates, Congress, and the American Democracy. Good evening and welcome, Linda Fowler.
Hi there.
Hi. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
With us from New Jersey tonight, Gerald Pomper. He's professor of political science at the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers University. He's edited a series of books on presidential elections from 1976 to 2000. His upcoming book is Ordinary Heroes and American Democracy. Good evening and welcome, Gerald Pomper.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for being with us. Linda Fowler, to you first. You're there in New Hampshire. You've been watching this firsthand. We've been hearing some funny stories from up there about Dean yard signs coming down, Clark yard signs going up. What do you feel in the air? And has the Iowa impact hit yet?
Well, actually, the changes in Dean's fortunes began about a week ago before Iowa really had penetrated the national consciousness. Mm-hmm. And it was just a testament that the concerns that people had about Dean and their sort of deciding to take a second look, which they always do in January in New Hampshire. Dean would not be the first front runner to experience a slide in the polls in January. And so the yard signs actually started coming down before Iowa. I don't know whether, you know, at this stage of the game, the kind of hardcore Dean people are going to, you know, button their belts and get out there and work their hearts out, or whether, in fact, Dean peaked early.
I mean, the media is always looking for a fresh story, and Dean was everywhere a week ago, and now it's easy to say, mm-hmm. well, Dean's in the dumpster. But clearly, he's built a base of support that's mm-hmm. very fervent. But what about his whole strategy, the web, the new voters, bringing out that organization, unlike any quite that's ever been there before? What does Iowa say about that?
Well, the fact of the matter is Bill Bradley went to Iowa with the idea of turning out new voters, and it didn't work for him either. There's a reason why in the past political organizers have focused on the people who routinely show up at caucuses, and that is people who are typically not involved often have reasons why they're not, and they're harder to mobilize than most people think.
That's a little disappointing, isn't it? I mean, the idea of a kind of fresh wave of Democratic participants, that is small-d democracy participants, was an exciting one with Dean. Still is.
Well, this whole experience in Iowa is actually, I think, bad news for the Democratic Party generally.
Why is that?
What it showed is that labor unions are not as powerful as they used to be.
And Mr. Gephardt.
And so Gephardt really, you know, showed the effect of that. And that this new formula that Dean supposedly had discovered of the internet and lots of enthusiastic young people in sleeping bags pounding the pavements for him, that was supposed to be the kind of the magic bullet that the Democrats would use to offset the enormous fundraising advantage that Bush has. And so I would think that despite all the hullabaloo and the celebration from Kerry people and Edwards people, that there's a fairly sobering message behind what happened in Iowa.
Let's see Dick Gephardt off for just a moment here. He made his bowing out speech today in St. Louis, Missouri. He talked about the principles that he'd fought for, fairness for workers and security for seniors and opportunities for children. And then he got pretty emotional.
I love this country, and I love my family. The silver lining in all of this is that I'll finally get to see them at every opportunity, rather than when opportunities could be found. Jane, Matt, Chrissy, and Kate. Are my life. And to them, I'll always be grateful. God bless you all.
And off goes Dick Gephardt after a long and dedicated career. Gerald Pumper, what's your interpretation of what Iowa means for the Democrats generally? Good news, vigorous, vibrant group of contenders, or tough news, as Linda Fowler suggests?
Well, I don't agree with Linda. 55% of the people who voted in Iowa were new caucus goers, and that seems to me a lot of mobilization.
By whom?
Now, it wasn't Dean's mobilization. Those new people voted more for Kerry, but I don't think the party should be discouraged when it's recruiting new blood.
And you're saying they're coming in, so feel good about it. Brian Murphy, how does it look in New Hampshire in terms of the robustness now of this range of candidates? I mean, we sort of thought that Iowa would narrow the field. It seems, in a sense, to have expanded the field.
I think that's true. I mean, I would take the same view that Professor Pomper does, and that you have all these new caucus goers. And I think Dean's argument that he's going to bring new voters to the table and to the race still holds true. It's just that, you know, there are two sides to this equation. One is that you have to be able to get the new people to the polls, and then you have to make sure that they're going to vote for you. Mm-hmm. And I think Dean's organizational problem came about once those people got to the caucus. So they ended up breaking for Kerry and for Edwards more than they did for Dean, but they were pulled out by Dean. And I'd imagine that, you know, he's got 5,000 people on the ground. He's expecting about 5,000 people on the ground in New Hampshire. He's got 125 paid staffers, tremendous organization, and a huge fundraising base that he's built. All those votes, I think, eventually, you know, either next Tuesday, they're either going to, right, they'll either break for Dean or they'll break for someone else. It depends on how voters decide. You know, they seem to be very shrewd about making decisions concerning electability.
But you're saying that Howard Dean has brought new voters to the dance, but he can't be sure that they're going to stick with him.
I think that's true. I think that's the problem with new. I think that's one of the things that the Democratic Party, or that any party, has to contend with new voters, is that they're not creatures of habit yet. They're not experienced or schooled in the thinking that, you know, the person who provides you the car or provides you with a door knocker at the end of the day or makes sure that you go to you're at the polls, you don't necessarily owe that person your vote. You're doing something else. And so I think people are more interested in Democrats seem more interested in getting rid of George Bush and finding someone to do the job than in necessarily showing a brand loyalty to a particular candidate.
So they may skitter right off. Gerald Pumper, what about that? I mean, the overarching theme does seem to be whoever will beat George W. Bush. Is it always like that when the out-of-power, out-of-White-House party gets ready to bring up a challenger? Are they always looking for whoever can win, or is that more pronounced this year than usual?
I think it's much more pronounced. I can't remember a time at which electability was the number one or almost number one criterion. And I think it's an indication of how divided the country is and how angry many Democrats are at George Bush. And they just want to get at him. And Dean was the vehicle for that, maybe still will be. But if it ends up as a different candidate, they're going to go for him. They're just very angry and very anti-Bush.
Linda Fowler, do you sense that same sort of depth of whoever will win the White House in New Hampshire, or is it more particularly issue-driven by particular candidates?
Well, the benchmark that I have is some polling that I did with some colleagues at Dartmouth in 2000, and electability just had absolutely no impact on people's decisions about candidates. So 4 years later, I think it clearly is a factor, and I think it was a big factor in Wes Clark's rise in the state over the last couple of weeks.
And what do you see in Wes Clark right now? How far has he come? I don't know who the front runner or underdog here is anymore, but do you see him as a full-blooded contender for potentially the number one spot coming out of New Hampshire?
Well, I think he was the one who ate into Dean's support while everybody else was out in Iowa. So it's hard to tell now that the pack is all back, kind of who's actually going to take first position. But I think they're the sentiment that people are describing in the news media is real.
A sentiment for Clark. I want to turn to our callers and invite them in. John's calling from Jamestown, New York. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Oh, good evening. I thought you did a very respectful job with the service people's fathers last night, especially the real conservative one. But to get
Thank
back
you,
to tonight's point, I was going to make the point to your screener that if you take John McCain or Paul Tsongas, for example, I don't see where New Hampshire necessarily picks the nominee. And I've been kind of leaning toward Clark recently, and if he's still in the picture come Super Tuesday, where I would vote in New York, I would consider voting for him. And as your other guest said, I don't think that electability being a concern is wrong, because as last election proved, you have to be able to, that you don't have one election, you have 51 elections, and you have to win that electoral college. And George Bush has 7 more electoral votes in his red states on the map this time.
But you're looking at New Hampshire, and you're saying much ado about nothing. It doesn't really matter. Wes Clark will still be there down the pike, and you'll vote for him when he comes. Let me put that to our guests. Thanks for your call, John. Jill Pumper, how about it? How important is New Hampshire here in terms of momentum this year when you've got 2 Southern candidates, Edwards and Clark, sitting right up there in the high tier now?
Well, I hope I don't insult anybody in New Hampshire, but I think its importance has been exaggerated over the years. New Hampshire's benefited economically from that. But John McCain won New Hampshire. He's not president now. Pat Buchanan won New Hampshire. He's not president. Paul Tsongas won New Hampshire. He wasn't president. And we could end up with 4 defeats in a row for New Hampshire. And Bill Clinton, by the way, didn't win New Hampshire. He came in 2nd, and he called himself the comeback kid. But he still became president.
So it's a long, wild ride, whoever
Bush.
Wins there.
Yeah, George W. Bush, who lost in New Hampshire, he became president.
Linda Fowler, I hear you there.
Well, at the risk of sounding disloyal to my fellow Granite Staters,
yes.
I think what's really further undermined the kind of pivotal role of New Hampshire is the fact that there are so many states having caucuses or primaries immediately after New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm.
There used to be some kind of dead air. Where
now, February 3rd,
yeah.
Arizona, Delaware, Missouri,
right.
New Mexico, North Dakota. Sounds like Howard Dean.
I mean, the day after New Hampshire is over, everybody is taking off, and there won't be any time for people to kind of chew on New Hampshire. It'll be sort of off to, well, what's the next thing? And as far as Dean's candidate is concerned, I think the terrain immediately after New Hampshire is more favorable to some other candidates.
And, of course, South Carolina right next to John Edwards' home state.
But it's not just South Carolina.
Of course not. It's a big list there.
Yeah.
Ryan is calling from Boston. Hi, Ryan. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Evening.
I just wanted to make the comment. I think certainly the issue of electability comes into play with voters' decision making. But I think in watching after John Kerry's victory last night,
mm-hmm.
and watching the media try to put a spin on it, I think a lot of they're trying to concentrate on. It seems like they're trying to find reasons as to why people are voting for John Kerry. When I think. It really, in the case of Iowa specifically, it really is issues. These
You're saying it's hiding in
there.
Plain sight. It's what he's saying that counts.
Right. I mean, these candidates were down in Iowa for well over a year, and I think it's too bad, you know, that every state in the country doesn't get that opportunity. But John Kerry is the only candidate, it seems to me, who has real ideas to address the issues that are going to be forthcoming, you know, end our dependence on foreign oil, a realistic
right.
health care plan,
mm-hmm.
something, you know, I volunteered in his campaign fresh out of college, and he's got an idea of putting young people to work in national service. I mean, I was so desperate for something like that coming out of college that I just walked into his office and volunteered.
And signed up. So you're right there with him on the issues. We've got it, Ryan, and thanks for your call. Brian Murphy, how about that? In New Hampshire, I mean, electability, I don't think is entirely a code word for everything other than issues. It includes issues, doesn't it? But how much do you sense in New Hampshire people are looking at issues, positions, and how much they're looking at persona?
Well, I think they're looking at a combination of the two, and issues strike at electability in that, you know, people are asking themselves how, you know, first of all, how certain policies are going to affect them and how they're going to play in the rest of the country. I think voters in New Hampshire are aware that that New Hampshire is a state that's a very different environment than a place like South Carolina or Arizona or California or New York. And I would imagine that, you know, this issue of electability doesn't necessarily diminish ideas, the value of ideas in a campaign, but it definitely puts them in a larger context. And that I think voters sort of imagine, Democratic primary voters are sitting there and imagining what kinds of ads George W. Bush is going to run against a particular candidate come August.
Which means what are that candidate's vulnerabilities?
Yeah, right. And I think that's where Dean's sort of shoot-from-the-lip style got him into some trouble, I think, in Iowa. And that, you know, once he's proclaimed the front runner, we don't really know if he was or not, but
yep.
he was apparently the front runner and had the Gore endorsement. All these little misstatements matter a lot more.
Like,
other people made them too, but for Dean, they had consequences.
They appear to have in Iowa. Linda, how about it? What does electability mean as far as you can tell this year? Is it issues? Is it personality, persona? Track record, all of it, how do you dissect it?
I think that's something that pollsters haven't really got a very good handle on, although actually it is a combination of issues and personality, and the best models that we have in political science really take account of both of those, and of course partisanship when you're in the general election. I think what we need to remember about New Hampshire, though, is that compared to some of the other primary states, the turnout in New Hampshire is really, really high. And so one of the things that's interesting about New Hampshire is that the candidates have to be tested not just in terms of whether they appeal to core party voters, who are often more at the extremes of the ideological spectrum, but also whether the weak partisans and even the undeclared voters are
the independents who pile in there.
Yeah. And so in some ways, it's a very different kind of test than you have in Iowa, and a different kind of test than you'll get in South Carolina.
But when they're looking, a voter's looking for a persona that they think can effectively go up against George Bush and find his vulnerabilities, what do you think they're looking for this year?
Are you asking me?
Yes.
I think they want somebody who's going to address the concerns they have about health care and the direction of the country in terms of foreign policy, although the data on foreign policy are very contradictory. Jerry could probably speak better about that. He's more of an expert on public opinion than
I. We'll come back to that. We've got to take
yeah.
a short break. We're talking tonight about upset in Iowa and the crowded house of Democratic contenders. You can join the conversation. Democrats, does the Iowa outcome have you rethinking your choices? Republicans, are you scared yet or more confident than ever? And has Howard Dean shouted himself off the stage, or will Kerry be a one-week wonder? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the upset in Iowa and the crowded house of Democratic contenders now descending on New Hampshire. You can join the conversation. What is the bottom line message from Iowa? What does it mean for the contenders and for the Democrats' chances in November? Is all the hubbub strengthening the Democrats' challenge to George Bush or not? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from New York by Brian Murphy, senior editor at politicsnh.com, from Hanover, New Hampshire by Linda Fowler, professor of policy studies at Dartmouth College, and from New Jersey by Gerald Pomper, professor of political science at Rutgers University. Jay is calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Hi, Jay. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
First off, I'd like to say that definitely when I think of in terms of electability, the first thing that I always think about is the commercials that the Republican are going to run against whoever.
So who looks good in the commercials in your mind's eye, Jay?
Sorry?
Who looks good in those commercials in your mind's eye?
I tell you, Howard Dean does not look good.
Why?
And especially after last night. One of the things I would like to ask somebody who maybe saw his speech last night and, you know, the so-called rebel yell, I'm just wondering if that was as ugly to view as it was to hear. I heard it on the radio this morning, and I found it to be rather chilling.
And what did it leave you? What did it leave you thinking, feeling, Jay?
Excuse me?
What did it leave you thinking, feeling?
It left me, you know, thinking that he's sort of the freak show that everyone has sort of labeled him. I found it to be kind of chilling.
It was an extreme political moment, one for the archives, no doubt. I guess we had to do it. Let's listen to it. Here's Howard Dean last night talking to his supporters after his poor showing in Iowa.
If you had told us 1 year ago that we were going to come in third in Iowa, we would have given anything for that. And you know something? You know something? Not only are we going to New Hampshire, Tom Harkin, we're going to South Carolina and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Dakota and New Mexico. We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House.
Howard Dean last night, if he had only let it go at New Mexico, Gerald Pomper, he might have been all right. But that took us into some pretty wild tonal territory. You're the electoral historian. How unusual a performance was that?
Well, I think the reason that's getting emphasized is because really there aren't that many issue differences among the Democratic candidates. Gephardt was a little different because of his opposition to free trade, and he's gone. Joe Lieberman is pretty conservative, but he's going to be gone after next week, I think. And then if you look at the differences among all the rest, they're really matters of detail. And so when there aren't real issue differences, then you start emphasizing the temperament and the character. And that's why Dean's over-the-top speech makes people wonder whether he's got the temperament to be president, much less to be a candidate against George Bush.
Linda Fowler, what do you make of that moment last night? Temperament was already on the table here, but is it really a small thing? Is it just because there's a fair confluence on the issues, or was that something that's going to stick in the back of people's minds?
Well, it depends on who else loses it. It seems to me that
object lesson may fend them off that, though.
That when the candidates are this tired,
yeah,
and the inhumane schedule that has been imposed upon them by the DNC this time, I mean, it's always been punishing. It's just even, you know, orders of magnitude worse. That I don't think this is the only mistake we're going to see in the next couple of weeks.
Well, it sure was. It sure was a high-pitched one, though. Brian Murphy, have you heard feedback from folks in New Hampshire on Dean's speech today?
Yeah, the feedback I've heard from, actually, you know, for people I talked to today, actually all over the from all over the place, it's been the one moment that's been on people's lips, and you kind of wonder if. I think Professor Pomp is right that once the issues are kind of distinctions of issues are blurred, or unclear or non-existent, that these issues of personality rise to the top. But gosh, you wonder if this is one of those moments when people are finally starting to tune into this campaign, and there's a tremendous number of people watching Howard Dean at this moment who have only heard stories about him being, you know, a little bit rough around the edges performance-wise. And if this is the introduction they had, or the reintroduction they've had in the new year,
hello, Dolly,
could have been a devastating moment.
Let's hear Howard Dean in a much more subdued tone early this morning in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
I used to be the front runner when I went out to Iowa, but I'm not the front runner anymore. But New Hampshire has a great tradition of supporting the underdog. So guess what? Let's go get them!
Kay is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Kay. You're on the air.
Hi. We were waiting for him to mention Wisconsin in the list of all the states because so many people from Wisconsin went to help him in Iowa.
It seemed like he almost got all 50 states, Kay, but he missed Wisconsin,
didn't
he?
Well, I know we were waiting, and two things. I used to be more interested in him in the last couple of weeks as he got more irritable and defensive, and at first I thought it was just tough schedule. You know, I'm sure he's exhausted. But he just, to me, seemed crabby, and I started wondering about his people skills, not only with the press, but whether he ever saw his family, and, you know, that some of that's up to him. But I really started questioning, and it reminds me in healthcare of two things, of the brilliant surgeon that you hope does your surgery, but you want the bedside manner of someone else to please be there.
Right.
Or the press agent in Iraq, you know, that said everything was going great even when...
Right. There are no American soldiers near here. Kay, if you fade off Howard Dean, which campaign do you expect to fade toward?
Well, the person that I'm most impressed with in the last 2 weeks has been John Edwards. And Kerry, I didn't know about. I love John Kennedy. I'm Irish, and the Wisconsin primary for Kennedy was an important one. But
Edwards has your eye.
Yeah, John Edwards, especially after he was endorsed by the paper, that made some sense to me because it was so unexpected. And then I've heard just tonight on McNeil-Lehrer and I'm hearing Democrats who really weren't for Edwards say that he's the best, most powerful speaker they've ever heard.
Well, he's going to have a lot more chance to show that. Kay, thanks for your call. There's one more voice we can't avoid having in here tonight because he's been campaigning so much in New Hampshire. Here's Wesley Clark today in Manchester.
It's the same race in the sense that what I've got to do is go out and communicate with the voters of New Hampshire. And whether it's Howard Dean, John Kerry, John Edwards, they were all going to be here anyway. And I'm running my own race. I'm working on the issues of the higher standard of leadership, working on a success strategy for Iraq, keeping America safe, talking about how to help ordinary working Americans.
Linda Fowler, Kerry Clark, two old soldiers, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
How do they carry that experience into New Hampshire? How's it look?
Oh, I think it's been the asset that everybody thought it would be. And I've been surprised at seeing Clark, the way he deals with liberal academic audiences up here in Hanover. I mean, he's really ended up kind of diffusing concerns that a lot of Democrats have of what's the general doing in our party.
How does he do it? What's the line?
Well, the best line that I've heard him use is, because I'm a general, I know both the way to use military power, but also when it isn't useful, and that or some variant of that. In other words, he understands both the strengths and the weaknesses of military power, and that seems to have resonated with a lot of Democrats who were kind of anti-war, but nevertheless seem to have been satisfied with that.
And maybe that's an electability factor, too. Brian Murphy, we're almost out of time here. Short time now to the election. Do you expect the polls are going to show us the way this time, too, or New Hampshire unpredictable?
I think the polls are going to be all over the map this week, to be honest. I'm not sure. I mean, the polls showed a neck and neck and neck and neck race yesterday, and we got something quite different. Now, it's a different kind of primary. It's obviously different from a caucus, but I am imagining that we're going to see a lot of volatility in the polls, and there's just going to be a tremendous amount of spending on commercial time, and there's already been so much.
No question, and a lot of volatility on the stump as well, perhaps. Yeah. Brian Murphy at politicsnh.com, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
And Gerald Pomper at Rutgers, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Tom.
Linda Fowler, professor of policy studies at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, observing another symbol of American democracy in Iowa. This is On Point. For the past few weeks, Iowa has been overrun with presidential candidates making their final sweeps through the state. Today, as the camera crews, pollsters, and eager campaign workers pull up their stakes and clear out, we look to the Iowan banks of the Mississippi River, where hopeful crowds of another sort gathered last week. They weren't looking to shake hands with a Democrat, but to observe the bald eagle, that majestic and elusive symbol of American democracy in its riverine habitat. Naturalist Ken Kaufman is editor of the Kaufman Focused Guides series, the palm-sized guides carried by bird watchers and nature lovers. In this radio diary, Ken steers away from the political parade to witness the Quad Cities' annual Bald Eagle Days.
4 days ago, I was standing among a crowd of people in Iowa staring at symbols of American pride, and there wasn't a presidential candidate in sight. It was not a political rally. It was part of a nature festival, the annual Bald Eagle Days in the Quad Cities. Okay, I admit, the Quad Cities are only half in Iowa, with Bettendorf and Davenport, Iowa, facing Rock Island and Moline, Illinois, across the river. But the stretch of the Mississippi River that runs between them usually stays at least partly unfrozen, even in the coldest weather. It has become a major wintering area for our national bird. Bald eagles from throughout the upper Midwest and central Canada concentrate here from about November through February. At times there may be more than 2,000 of them along the river within a few miles of the Quad Cities. Now, for a bird, the bald eagle is huge. At rest, it sits more than 2 feet tall. In the air, its wingspan may stretch up to 8 feet from wingtip to wingtip. It usually feeds on fish or even on carrion washed up on shore, but it can be a formidable hunter, preying on animals as large as geese or even foxes. It isn't really bald, of course, but the white feathered head and white tail, contrasting with the dark brown body and the hooked yellow beak, make it just as unmistakable in real life as it is on the military recruiting posters. So, yes, bald eagles are impressive, even if you see them just one at a time, which is usually the case elsewhere in the lower 48 states. When you see dozens at once, the effect is stunning. It also seems a little unreal to have these big predators just sitting around side by side, standing together on the ice at the river's edge, or perched in the bare trees, broad shoulders hunched against the wind. They could do serious damage to each other with those massive talons and heavy hooked beaks, but they seem to get along peacefully most of the time. Sometimes there are disagreements, maybe two or three eagles fighting over a dead fish, and they may take to the air with slow, powerful wing beats, chasing each other with swoops and dives and barrel rolls, like heavyweight wrestlers in an aerial ballet. Mostly they are silent, and that's just as well, since their voice is hardly the regal scream you might expect from our official bird. It's more of a hoarse cackling or chirping. Regardless, when the eagles start to fight, lesser birds like gulls and ducks all scatter out of their way. It's no wonder the Quad Cities organized a special event around these birds, and no wonder the event has grown. It's now attracting over 20,000 people annually. But remarkably, at the same time, the numbers of eagles have been increasing as well. As recently as 3 decades ago, the bald eagle was in serious trouble. Tens of thousands had been shot during the first half of the 20th century, and even after this practice was stopped, the effects of certain pesticides were sharply lowering their rates of reproduction. By the time the eagle was placed on the endangered species list in 1978, there were probably fewer than 1,000 nesting pairs left in the lower 48 states. Today, after years of rigorous protection and reintroduction efforts, there are well over 5,000 pairs there, and the numbers are still growing. Other people may see the bald eagle as a symbol of patriotism or strength or courage, but to naturalists it symbolizes something else, the fact that conservation efforts can produce big results. With all this symbolism in the air, I really expected a few presidential hopefuls to show up, to strut their environmental credentials or to pose for photo ops. But they didn't. So those of us in attendance were able to forget about politics for a while and just appreciate the bald eagles, not as symbols, but as magnificent wild birds.
Ken Kaufman is editor of the Kaufman Focus Guide series. He lives in Tucson, Arizona. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.